Good morning, everybody. We'll get started with our session today. My name is Andy Baker White. Welcome to this law section session. It's entitled The Multidisciplinary Examination of Laws, Policies, and Debates to Address Injury. Today we have with us to speak on this topic. First, we have Christine Baugh, who's a doctoral student in the Health Policy Program at Harvard University. And also next to her, we have Carrie McGowan-Lowry, who's the Deputy Director for the Network for Public Health Law's Eastern Region, which is at the University of Maryland Francis King Carey School of Law. And also we have Jose Harvey, who is an Associate Professor of Law and Political Science at Temple University, as well as Daniel Goldberg, an Assistant Professor in the Department of Bioethics at the Brody School of Medicine at East Carolina University. And finally, we have Caitlin Perry, who is here on behalf of Boston University School of Public Health, but is currently a chronic disease health specialist for the Lawrence Douglas County Health Department in Lawrence, Kansas. So our panelists today are going to speak for about 10 minutes on their topics. They are asking the audience to make this an interactive session, so if you have questions, feel free to ask them when you have them, to not wait at the end. And I think we'll try to go from there. All right. Thank you, Christine.
So first, I just want to give a special thanks to Kathleen Baczynski, who, although she's not here today, did a lot of work to bring this group of people together to put forth a multidisciplinary approach to try to understand how policy can affect injury prevention through the lens of the concussion crisis. Okay. So today I will be talking to you a little bit about what we can learn about policy through the lens of the athlete perspective and how concussion reporting in a population of college football players can teach us a little bit about policy intervention. And just disclosures, my conference travel was funded by the Petrie Flom Center as well as Harvard's Graduate Student Council. I was funded for research from the Edmund J. Saffer Center for Ethics. I'm a research graduate student for the NCAA, and my doctoral education is supported by the National Institutes of Mental Health. So let's start from the basics. Everything we're going to be talking about today relates to brain injury, so let's discuss what a concussion actually is. A concussion is a brain injury. It's a subset of what some people call mild traumatic brain injury. It's caused by rapid acceleration and then deceleration of the brain within the skull. This could be from a contact directly to the head or from a contact in the body that causes the head to move back and forth. A concussion does not require loss of consciousness. The symptoms of concussion are highly variable, ranging from relatively seemingly minor headaches or nausea that lasts for a very short period of time to something that can last much longer, on the order of weeks, or in some prolonged cases called post-concussion syndrome, even for months. The injury itself is thought most generally of as a metabolic injury. At the cellular level, the neurotransmitters are sort of out of balance, rather than a structural injury. It's not a bruise on the brain. When you put a person in an MRI or a CT scanner, using traditional methods, you won't see anything wrong structurally. So that you can see that sort of graphic there, just an illustration of it's the brain moving within the skull and unfortunately hitting the skull through the acceleration, deceleration. So why is this a problem? The scope is part of the issue. So concussions can occur through a variety of activities, one of which is competitive sport. In the United States, around 44 million youth and adolescents participate in competitive organized sport at the college or high school levels each year. So that's a large number of people who are exposed to activities that may result in brain injury. In that population, sports are second only to car accidents as the cause of brain injury. So it is a high causal rate of brain injury through participation in sports. And the overall estimates that the CDC has provided for the number of brain injuries in the United States annually is somewhere between 1.6 and 3.8 million, a very broad range, in part because the number of concussions or brain injuries that are reported is much less than what we think the actual number of injuries are, which is where I'm going to be going today. When we think of concussions, oftentimes football comes up. But I put this graphic up mostly to illustrate that this is not just a football problem. A number of sports, contact and collision sports in particular, provide the opportunity for athletes. This is at the high school level, but the rates are similar at the college level as well, to sustain a brain injury. So football is the largest, and this is in part because the teams are large, also in part because the activity itself is inherently dangerous, requiring people to run into each other as part of the game. But the other sports are non-negligible. Soccer, both at the men's and women's level. You'll notice that in that game, where the rules are the same for both men and women, women sustain a much larger fraction of injuries, and women are unfortunately very understudied in the area of brain injury. Now, what can public health do? And when we think about policy and public health strategies to address injuries in general and concussions specifically, public health frameworks puts this in terms of primary, secondary, and tertiary prevention. In the optimal world, primary prevention is our largest strategy. We want to prevent the injuries from actually occurring. We want to intervene prior to the injury happening. If we can't do that, or we can't address it sufficiently, we then move to secondary and tertiary prevention, trying to control the risk factors, reduce the exposure, intervene early when possible after an injury has occurred, and then once an injury has occurred, do our best to reduce those complications, minimize the burden of the injury, both on the individual as well as on the public's health. And a good frame for thinking about intervention from a public health sphere is the social ecological model. I'm sure many of you have heard of this or applied it in your own setting. But policy operates at the broadest of levels. Policy in the social ecological model is the broadest level on the spectrum, sort of overseeing or influencing all levels below it, including environment, interpersonal issues, and intrapersonal issues. So specific to concussion, the policies can come from the sport league level, they can come from the state, they can come from a coach implementing certain policies on his team to try to intervene. Within that, they're constrained by the environment. So if we say at the state level that everybody should be evaluated for concussion if it's suspected, that is constrained by whether or not there's a medical professional available to do that evaluation. And then furthermore, down at the intra and interpersonal levels, what motivations allow athletes or promote athletes' disclosure of concussion symptoms, and how do those in their environment act to improve or, unfortunately, perhaps sometimes dissuade them from doing so. So most of my colleagues today will be talking about the policy level, talking about how policy can influence things everywhere below it. Today I'm going to be focusing more on the intra and interpersonal levels from the athlete perspective and trying to understand what we can learn there and sort of provide feedback to the policy level in order to improve effectiveness. So in order to address the issue of concussion and concussion reporting, I conducted a research study. It was survey-based in a population of college football players. I want to take a step back and let everybody know that the reason why concussion reporting really matters is that there's no biomarker to diagnose concussion. There's no brain scan that you can do to diagnose concussion. And more often than not, concussion is not necessarily externally observable. So the athlete will feel something after an impact, and they will then have to approach a medical provider or a coach if one is not available to disclose that they have been feeling symptoms since the impact in order to be evaluated. So because there's no biomarker, there's no objective, in the strongest sense of the word, test for concussion, it often relies on athlete honest disclosure of symptoms. So I conducted this research study. 817 football players participated, and 800 answered the questions that I'm going to talk a little bit about today. They were representative of two regions of the United States and nine different teams across those two regions. And the question that I asked, one of the questions that I asked, the one I'll be talking about today, is, have you ever sustained a blow to the head that you suspect was a concussion but you did not report your symptoms? And in line with many other research studies, we found about half of these football players indicated that they did not report the symptoms when they suspected they had sustained a concussion. So the next logical question is why? And among the football players, what we learned is that they, unsurprisingly, didn't want to leave the game, didn't want to let their teammates or their coaches down, or in some cases they didn't think that the injury was serious enough to report. So if we think of those reasons and we think back to that social ecological model, you'll notice that all of the reasons are on the intrapersonal and the interpersonal level, and mostly at the interpersonal. I don't want to let my teammates down. I don't want to let my coach down. I don't want to stop playing in the game in this environment that I'm currently existing in. And possibly the intrapersonal level with the I don't think it's serious enough, that may be a knowledge issue. So if policy is acting at this most broad level, and some of the reasons for non-report are at the lower levels of the spectrum, what can we do to bridge this gap? So this is not the only study. It's probably not the best study, examining this issue. There's a lot of studies that have found something similar, that knowledge alone is not the problem, that it's the individual's environment, their personal relationships with their teammates and coaches that's highly influential of whether or not they'll disclose an injury. Perceived norms, subgroup dynamics, coach support or non-support, pressures from other actors in the environment are highly influential as to whether or not athletes, football players, or other athletes are willing to disclose possible concussion symptoms. Both state legislation as well as NCAA policy mandates education for athletes. This is one way in which the policy level is aiming to interact with that interpersonal level, intrapersonal level. Let's try to provide information that allows the intrapersonal, the individual, to recognize signs, symptoms, and what to do. Let's also try to provide, perhaps indirectly, information that their school is taking this seriously, that their medical provider has a plan if they do sustain an injury, that they know what to expect if they do disclose. Unfortunately, a lot of the education that's occurring today is highly variable, not well regulated. There's not a lot of guidance, and unfortunately often not very effective in the studies that have occurred on concussion education. What we do know is that targeting areas beyond concussion knowledge, beyond providing a list of signs and symptoms, will work to improve efficacy. Concussion knowledge alone will not influence athletes, at least at the high school and collegiate levels, to improve their concussion reporting behaviors. Additionally, at the NCAA level, which is where I was operating, they mandate that athletes acknowledge that they've received this education and that they have a role in reporting their symptoms. We could think of this as a way to try to promote an active engagement and acknowledgement of their role in reporting. Others have implicated this as a potential just liability mechanism, trying to ensure the athletes sign the piece of paper to say that they have some responsibility. Schools could utilize this as a way, beyond a mere sign-off, to improve athletes' recognition of their roles in this sort of interpersonal sphere to improve concussion reporting. And many of the stakeholders who are involved in both the education and acknowledgement components can utilize this opportunity to engage athletes in ways beyond the signs and symptoms, beyond the traditional sign-off, in order to indicate that there's a culture of safety, a culture in which reporting the injury is a valued behavior, and this, we think, will improve the actual reporting. Improving the rates of diagnosis of concussion is an important secondary prevention strategy. And I want to be clear that it is a secondary prevention strategy. Once the injury has occurred, we're beyond primary prevention. Optimally, this would act within a sphere of primary prevention. And many of my colleagues today will be talking a little bit more about how policy has been structured thus far and how perhaps the primary prevention expansion may improve rates overall beyond just improving rates of diagnosis. And that's all I have to say, but I just want to say thank you for your time and interest, for my panel members and to the collaborators and the athletes who participated in the research study. And if you have any questions, I'd be very happy to answer them.
Should we ask questions now?
If you'd like.
I'm just curious about the if the education is done at the lower level, the younger age,
Yeah, so there has been a dearth of research in youth athletes. This is in part because it's a bit less structured oftentimes in how the organization of the leagues exist, who is providing the education. Oftentimes at the lower levels, particularly within contact sports, we're talking about non-school leagues, so the Pop Warner footballs and those types of things. So seeing whether education at that age translates into better reporting behaviors both then and later on in life has not occurred. It also would take some time that I don't think people have not put in the longitudinal efforts to see. But it is very important at that age because, as you're saying, it may translate more broadly overall. If that culture of safety is ingrained in them earlier, it may be more believable, first of all, but also better improve the rates of disclosure of injury. It may be at that age that knowledge is actually where we make our gains. They just don't know what a concussion is, and if they hit their head and get a headache, they don't know what to make of that. So it is a very different sphere. Absolutely. And I think there have been some more general studies, not necessarily at the youth level, that suggest even the indirect social awareness, media coverage, those types of things have begun to change a bit of the culture. I don't know if specifically at the youth level, but even where there may not be the formalized education, just the broader recognition of the injury warranting medical care has been seen in some states that have implemented these laws to have improved rates of diagnosis. So I did not have the latter measure. The earlier measure I do have in the survey. I don't have the data in front of me here today, but I did analyze across starters and non-starters. In this particular sphere, there weren't any significant differences. Among the reasons that I didn't show you, the ones that were less often selected for reasons for non-report, I asked about, were you worried about losing your scholarship? Were you worried about losing your spot on the team? Were you worried about impacting the team's overall performance? Those things were selected by a smaller group of people. They were not as popular, so to speak, as these other ones. They, in some cases, did differ slightly across starters and non-starters. So starters think that they're not playing may affect the team performance more. So there are some slight differences, but across all groups, those mostly interpersonal reasons were the ones that were most frequently selected. These were D1 FCS. Yes. Yes. Yeah. That's a great question. So one of the works that I have forthcoming with Emily Crotius, we looked at rates of both reporting behaviors as well as intention across Division III athletes, a variety of sports, men's and women's. And what we found actually was not so much the gender that was predictive of the behavior, but rather how much the individual identified with traditionally masculine norms. So athletes in general tend to be more risk-seeking, tend to sort of go along the lines of what, you know, psychologists and other social scientists would call traditional masculine norms. And we found that that construct was more predictive, and in face of that construct, gender was not a significant variable. So it's not necessarily being male or being female so much as it is how you identify with certain behaviors or psychological constructs. And that makes some sense. That said, more females tend to maybe identify slightly less, and more males tend to identify slightly more. But those constructs can be addressed rather than being a male or being a female. So that's another area of potential intervention in concussion education, is how much do we promote or dissuade people from, you know, going for the big hit, or, you know, sucking it up when they get injured, and those other sort of traditionally masculine normative behaviors. But it is an area that warrants a lot of future study. Absolutely, yeah. So I was studying in this one, it was Division I, but it wasn't any of what's called the Power Five schools, the big schools that go to the bowl games and make all the money. This was other schools within Division I. So they are still very competitive. They do offer a number of scholarships, but they aren't the most competitive. I do agree that there may be different motivations across all of the different divisions of competition, as there may be between high school and college or a variety of sports. And I think it is an area that's an important one for inquiry, as well as across sports. I mean, I did a study in football, but there are a lot of areas in which concussions occur across all sports and genders, and a lot of focus, and I'm part of the problem, has been dedicated to football. But we really need to start to understand the phenomenon more generally, and I think your point about how do we generalize here is very well taken, and we need to start moving in a direction where we're not talking about the motivations of some small subgroup of all male competitive athletes.
I just wanted to respond probably to the question about knowledge. My name is Daniel Holberg, because I think, you know, this is in line with some things that I write, and I do public health ethics and public health law in particular, right? So, you know, we know beyond a shadow of a doubt that educating people is not an effective way of changing risky health behaviors when those risky health behaviors are strongly determined by upstream structural factors, right? And we wouldn't expect it to work, which is not to say I'm opposed to health education. I'm pro-health education. I just wouldn't expect it to change those kinds of risky health behaviors. You know, and it doesn't. And I think that part of the other problem is norm changing. You know, norm changing as a way of changing risky health behaviors. That there's more evidence for effectiveness of that. And there's lots of different ways you can work on changing norms, including a component can be education, mm-hmm. right? I think the other thing that concerns me, and I work on priorities, and we're talking today a little bit about what should our policy priorities be. That's what some of the content of this session is about. You know, I think that some of the issues, education can actually be wielded by those who are trying to preserve the status quo in policy discourse, okay? So say, look, all we need to do is arm people with the facts, okay? And then we don't really have to make any other kinds of structural policy changes as well. I mean, this is a well-worn technique that's been used in regulated industry for 50 or 60 years, right? You can always look at the tobacco industry. They've done this very effectively for a long time. So I think, you know, it's not that education, and I don't think this is inconsistent with anything you're saying, Christine. I don't think that, I'm not opposed to health education, but as an answer, if we identify concussion underreporting as a risky health behavior, you know, the idea of arming athletes of any kind with facts as a solution to this problem, I don't think is the policy priority. That's not the intervention we want to highlight. So.
Yeah, I agree.